From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Gays and lesbians are prohibited from serving in the military. The government says homosexuals are a threat to discipline and morale. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about gays and the military, past and present, with historian Alan Berube, author of the new book Coming Out Under Fire, The History of Gay Men and Women in World War II. Also today, advice on how to lead through respect, not intimidation, from Max Dupree. He's the head of what's been called one of the most admired companies in America. World music critic Milo Miles introduces us to the music of accordionist Steve Jordan, who plays the Mexican-American border music known as Conjunto. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Miami Blues. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet pressure on independence-minded Lithuania turned up another notch today as Soviet troops seized control of a government printing office in Vilnius. The military action came amid reports that the Soviets are cutting off food supplies to the Baltic nation, in addition to the fuel blockades imposed in the last 2 days. Benjamin Rowe reports from Moscow.
Lithuanian officials report a tense standoff in Vilnius, with about 50 Soviet troops currently inside a printing plant they took by force this afternoon, smashing windows and roughing up a volunteer security force. A handful of defiant workers are still inside the plant, refusing to leave, while the building is surrounded by onlookers and volunteer forces from the Lithuanian Interior Ministry. It's the latest move by Soviet troops to reclaim property for communists loyal to Moscow in their property dispute with the Independent Communist Party of Lithuania. The allegations of a potential food cutoff were made tonight at a press conference by Deputy Prime Minister Romualdas Ozolas. He stated that shipments of Latvian fish and Cuban sugar were diverted from the port of Klaipeda by Soviet customs officials, but the Lithuanian Council of Ministers declined to confirm the account. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
The Soviet Union's ambassador to the U.S. said today that chances are better for a fair and honest dialogue between Moscow and Lithuania. Ambassador Yuri Dubinin told reporters that new legislation adopted by the Soviet Parliament implements the constitutional right to secede. He said that legislation could serve as the basis for dialogue with Lithuania. Diplomatic efforts are believed to be continuing to secure the release of one of the American hostages held by pro-Iranian groups in Lebanon. The move comes after the postponement by one of the groups to set free one of its three American captives. Today, a senior Shiite Muslim leader in Lebanon who's closely allied with them said their offer was a serious one, but the timing of any release depended on Washington's response. Tim Llewellyn of the BBC has this report from the Syrian capital of Damascus.
Hussein Mousawi, head of a group called Islamic Amal, or Islamic Hope, and known to be close to the kidnappers, Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine, said the decision to release an American hostage was not going to be reversed. The failure of the senior American diplomat responsible for the Middle East, John Kelly, to come to Damascus as requested by the kidnappers would not cancel the decision, he said. How soon the hostage might be released would depend on how far-sighted the Americans might become. Their behavior had so far, he said, been arrogant, one of cowboy mentality. Syrian sources confirm that the Kelly question was central to the delay, and it's known that Syria is working hard to resolve the issue.
The BBC's Tim Llewellyn. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost another 16 points to close at 2,695.72. Declines led advances by a margin of 5-2 in active trading. This is NPR News. More than 50,000 demonstrators snarled traffic in Lower Manhattan today as they marched to protest a federal AIDS policy they say discriminates against Haitians. City officials say the Brooklyn Bridge was closed and many local streets were jammed by the poorly organized marchers. The march was called to protest a federal policy prohibiting anyone who's emigrated from Haiti from giving blood. The Food and Drug Administration says the ban extends to Haiti and some African countries because the AIDS virus is so widespread there. The family of Loyola Marymount basketball star Hank Gathers, who collapsed and died during a game on March 4th, filed a multi-million dollar lawsuit today against doctors and university officials. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
According to the suit filed today in Los Angeles Superior Court, Hank Gathers was sacrificed on the altar of basketball. The suit names the university athletic director and the coach and trainer of the basketball team, as well as seven doctors, as co-defendants. Gathers had been diagnosed with a heart ailment after collapsing on the court December 9th. He was supposed to take medication. The suit charges that under pressure from the coach, Gathers' medication was reduced below therapeutic levels and that on the day of his death, physicians on the scene failed to resuscitate the athlete for nearly 3 minutes until he could be removed from the stadium. Loyola Marymount University has issued a brief statement expressing sadness at the charges contained in the lawsuit and saying that the university and staff will be vindicated at the time of the trial. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The FBI has joined an investigation into the suspected firebombing of the home of a nuclear plant inspector in Tennessee. The fire gutted the home of Ken Jennison, a senior inspector for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Jennison is the NRC's chief inspector at the troubled Sequoia nuclear plant. An NRC spokesman said Jennison received 4 threatening phone calls before the suspected firebombing. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Blacks and women have won the right to serve in the military. Homosexuals have not. They're barred from military service. Gays who are discovered in the military face investigation, interrogation, and discharge. My guest, Alan Berube, is a gay historian and author of the new book Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. According to Berube, over 18 million men and women were screened by draft boards during the war. Only 4,000 to 5,000 were rejected for homosexuality. Berube says the homosexuals who made it through the screening process found themselves fighting 2 wars, one for American democracy and freedom, the other for their own survival as homosexuals within the military organization. I asked Berube to describe the current regulation that bans homosexuals from the military.
Right now, it declares that homosexuality is incompatible with military service and that anyone who has a propensity towards homosexuality is a threat to the military.
What does propensity for homosexuality mean?
It means either that you say that you're a homosexual or that you might want to be in a homosexual relationship, anything indicating that you might be gay or lesbian.
What is the military's reason for thinking that homosexuality is incompatible with serving in the military?
That's a very good question. I wish they would start talking about it. They're not talking about it. They just make these assertions and statements and don't give the evidence or reasons behind the policy. All we can do is guess, I think. I mean, what they say is that gay men and women are a threat to security, morale and discipline, recruitment, public relations, privacy. It's basically, if you believe all of it, it means that the presence of a homosexual would completely destroy the entire military organization. That can't be the truth. I mean, it's just not true. So you can guess that it might be that they don't want it to be known that there are homosexuals in the military. That's my guess.
Mm-hmm. When the military says that gays and lesbians endanger national security, that's because they think that gays and lesbians could be more easily blackmailed by people who are threatening to drag them out of the closet?
That's right. And on surface, that sounds like it makes sense. In fact, there have been no cases of any gay man or lesbian who have been blackmailed in the military for being gay. So it's a hypothetical question that there's no evidence to back it up.
And the fear that gays and lesbians would hurt recruitment, that has to do with that straight people would be fearful of serving knowing that there were gays and lesbians in their midst?
Yeah. I mean, it's really kind of ridiculous because there's gay men and lesbians everywhere. The fear, I think, is if the military were to say that there were gay men and lesbians in the military, then other people would be afraid to join up.
The Supreme Court recently declined to hear 2 appeals, one by a gay and one by a lesbian, who were discharged for homosexuality. Do you consider this a great setback?
Not necessarily. That's what we expected, pretty much. And it doesn't indicate anything, really. It's just because they didn't say why they didn't hear them. The traditional policy of the courts, the stance of the courts, is to defer to the military in most of these cases. That really it's up to the military to decide what they want to do.
One of the current issues surrounding gays in the military has to do with ROTC on college campuses. And major universities have been warning the Pentagon that anti-gay policies are generating pressure to ban ROTC from campus. And this week, John Deutsch, the provost of MIT, wrote a letter to Defense Secretary Dick Cheney saying, quote, "The contradiction between the university's principle of non-discrimination against individuals on the basis of sexual orientation and the presence of an ROTC that does discriminate cannot exist on the campuses indefinitely. What's the background to this? Is this a story you've been following?
Yes. During most of this year, there have been a number of cases on many college campuses, and increasing numbers of cases, it seems, or there's more publicity given to them, of gay ROTC students being kicked off out of the programs because they are gay. The worst one, one of the worst cases, was in St. Louis, where a man came out in his senior year and was ordered to pay back his entire scholarship of $25,000 or more. The policy is patently mean-spirited. I mean, it just seems to be unfair for people to have to pay back their scholarships when they come out. And it seems that way on campuses. And so what's interesting is that there's faculty on campuses and young students on campuses who are both bringing up this issue of discrimination.
Alan Berube is my guest, and he's written a new book on the history of gay men and women in the military in World War II, and the book is called Coming Out Under Fire. Alan, do you know how the spread of AIDS is affecting the way the military treats homosexuals and the way the military perceives homosexuality?
Yes, the military was one of the first federal organizations to begin mandatory testing. It was the first one, I think, of its personnel. And as a result, thousands and thousands of young people, primarily those who are coming into the military, have been tested. Where the danger is in terms of homosexuality is where the military equates being antibody positive with being gay, which is certainly not the case at all. And the other difficulty for the military is that they are finding people who are antibody positive who are doing their jobs well, and the policy of wanting to discharge everybody who is antibody positive becomes difficult for the organization. So they've been trying to figure out ways of keeping people in even though they're antibody positive. And in a way, it really brings up the contradictions with the anti-gay policy, too, because, in fact, the military does not want and cannot discharge everyone who is gay or lesbian. Otherwise, it would be so disruptive of the military organization it couldn't function. So what it tries to do is try to figure out ways to keep people quiet about being gay.
Your new book, Coming Out Under Fire, is an examination of gays and lesbians during World War II in the military.
That's right.
Why are you looking to World War II?
World War II, I discovered, was the beginning of the military's anti-gay discharge policy. It had no such policy in World War I, and it was in the middle of World War II, in January of 1943 to be exact, when both the Army and the Navy adopted policies to discharge homosexuals from the armed forces.
And what was the reason for that?
It's a funny story. It's kind of an irony because it was spearheaded in part by psychiatrists who were objecting to the military's previous practice of putting men convicted of sodomy into prison for 10 to 12 years. They felt that was cruel and unjust, and that their new idea was that homosexuals were mentally ill, not criminals, and therefore should be discharged. I mean, that's an argument that's been discredited in the 1970s. But at that point, it was a progressive argument, and it was positioned against the military's treating homosexuals as criminals. So it was just that moment in time when psychiatrists were beginning to have an influence in the armed forces. It backfired on them right away, and the other military officials started using the policy to punish gay men and then lesbians as women got into the armed forces for being gay.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe what the screening process was during World War II for screening out gays and lesbians?
Yeah, that was introduced again for the first time during World War II. And at the induction centers and draft boards, the examiners would say to the men, do you like girls? Actually, they were supposed to say, are you a homosexual or do you have homosexual tendencies? But many of them, I think, were shy about that. And many young men had no idea what that word meant, homosexual. So they would say, do you like girls? They didn't screen women for homosexuality until in the Women's Army Corps until late in the war, until late 44, after which, when most of the women had already been recruited. Part of that was because of the pressure to conserve all female personnel as much as possible because the Women's Army Corps had much difficulty meeting their quotas during the war.
How did the screening process that was created during World War II compare with today's screening process?
It's very similar. They still ask people if, now they ask enlisted personnel if they have homosexual tendencies. Apparently they ask officers, do you have any problems with homosexuality? During the Vietnam War, it was interesting because so many people were, it was such an unpopular war, and homosexuality had lost some of its stigma, that many, many people said they were gay, or some heterosexual draftees claimed to be gay in order to avoid military service. There's no evidence that that happened during World War II.
Mm-hmm. So previously, if you were caught in the act of sodomy, you were sent to prison. In
yes.
World War II, when that was changed and homosexuality was considered a psychiatric problem, were the consequences, how did the consequences change?
People still got sent to prison. There was always that backup policy. That policy still exists. And two lesbians were just sentenced to prison and served their sentences for sodomy last year at Parris Island in the Marine Corps. So that system still exists. How it changed is it allowed the military to discharge someone, this is in World War II, with an undesirable discharge. You lost your benefits and you lost your GI rights, and you had an undesirable discharge, which could affect your employment too, especially during the war. And it allowed the military to punish a lot much larger group of people, because the number of people who could be sent to prison, the prisons had only so much space, but there was no place to hold people in for years and years if they were discharged. So the numbers increased a lot over the numbers of people who could have been sent to prison. It also allowed the military to deal with women, because women were generally not sent to prison for offenses like this. And they could be punished nevertheless. Also, people didn't have any rights before a discharge board. None of the rights of due process that you would have at a trial if you had been charged with sodomy.
Is the discharge still a dishonorable discharge?
Currently, for the most part, it's honorable. It's an honorable discharge and mandatory. In other words, if the regulation is anyone who is known to be homosexual has to be discharged. The irony right now is that if a man gets caught having sex with another man, but he says that he is not gay, then he can be maintained in the, retained in the military. Hmm. It's the being gay, not the sex act so much, that is disturbing to the military.
What were the interrogations like when the military is trying to get a confession from a gay or lesbian?
They were excruciating and really incredibly invasive, cruel situations. They would usually be more than one person interrogating a person. Say, at Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, there was an intensive investigation that involved interrogations in early 1944. They would take a woman in one by one and sit her down and ask her if she was a homosexual, and that we have evidence that you've engaged in homosexual practices. She would be completely shocked and taken aback, told that she could not talk to anybody else about what was going on, and then systematically asked incredibly personal questions about her sexual activities, her sexual pleasures, what positions she took, and it just got incredible detail. And each time that a woman would start crying, for instance, and they would just move in to try to get names of people that she knew, the goal was to get her to confess to being a homosexual or a man who was being interrogated and get them to name names of other people.
Are there still, is there still interrogation of gays and lesbians in the military?
Yes, there still is.
And the idea is the idea still to get that person to confess and to name other people?
Yes, yes, exactly. And in the policy says that someone needs, it has to be discharged if they state that they have a propensity towards homosexuality, that statement can take place under interrogation. In other words, if you're interrogated for hours and hours and grilled, and you finally admit that you're gay, that's what the statement is, that you are gay, and that's sufficient to get you discharged. So that's what they're looking for, is that admission. People often think that it's someone saying out loud in public, I am gay, and then they're the problem ones. But that statement can take place after hours and even days of interrogations.
Alan, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Alan Berube, who writes about the social and political history of gay men and lesbians in America. His new book is called Coming Out Under Fire, The History of Gay Men and Women in World War II. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Alan Berube is my guest, author of Coming Out Under Fire, The History of Gay Men and Women in World War II. Do you think there was a gay subculture in the military during the war?
It was there, yes, and it was actually quite extensive, although secret and quiet. But as far as I can tell, there were the gay cliques and gay circles of friends and lesbian circles of friends on virtually every base in the United States of any size. They would hang out at the service clubs sometimes or hang out, meet each other in town at the a local gay bar. They had all kinds of clever ways that they would just discover from meeting each other. One woman told me that she took out a book on the Air Force Base library that was called Diana. It was a lesbian novel from 1939. You know, there was like 20 books on the library, and one of these was a lesbian novel. She put her name in the back, and then she returned it. And then a gay man had taken it out after her, noticed her name, and that's how they met each other.
Hmm. Now, you said that after World War II, restrictions against gays and lesbians actually tightened.
Yes.
Why?
I think because the constraints of wartime, which pressured military officials to conserve all personnel, the men and the women, those constraints were lifted so that the anti-gay policy that really emerged during the war could be could develop even more fully. In other words, they could, especially against lesbians, because lesbians after the war in the military, women in the military after the war, became a much more deviant type of group. All the other women were leaving the military. They were moving, you know, into the families and homes, into more traditional female role, jobs for women. Those women who chose to stay in the military were seen to be more deviant than they had been during the war, where they were seen as being patriotic and really serving their country.
In the early 1950s, the military restrictions against gays were extended to the rest of the government.
That's right.
How did that happen?
There was a hearing during the McCarthy era, and the anti-communist hearings in the Senate during 1950 expanded in the middle of that year to include homosexuals. There were a few anti-gay and anti-communist senators who wanted to start holding hearings, which they did, about what they called the employment of homosexuals and other sex perverts in government. The Senate investigative committees held hearings all through the late part of 1950, and what they wanted to do was to take this model the military had developed, which was to have an anti-gay policy towards its personnel and extend that to the entire government. Their argument was that all homosexuals were security risks, and that was what they were trying to promote. They succeeded, and within a couple of years, President Eisenhower issued an executive order making it mandatory to not hire and to fire anyone in the federal government who was known to be gay. It also applied to all private contractors with the federal government.
Do you have any estimate of how many homosexuals were fired from federal positions, from government positions then?
It was several thousand in the first part of the 1950s. In 1950 itself, it's interesting, during the first part of the year, it was an average of about six per month who were fired from the federal government for being gay. By the end of that year, it shot up to 60 per month, and it was directly related to this beginning of a really nationwide witch hunt against gay men and lesbians in federal jobs.
When was this hiring policy reversed?
Well, it still exists in a lot of cases, but I think civil service in the late 70s was had a new regulation saying that a lot of government employees would not be fired just because of their sexual orientation. The policy certainly still exists in the military and in many other federal agencies.
Okay, looking back at World War II, and the role and the condition of gays and lesbians in the war, mm-hmm. What effect do you think their participation in the military and the military's reaction to them had on the future gay rights movement? Any?
Yeah, I think it was in that relationship, in that conflict, were sown some of the seeds of the later gay rights movement. This is another irony of this story. Those who were discharged, there were at least 9,000 or to 10,000 during the war. Because of the new GI rights bill, they were already avenues for appealing those discharges available to them at the end of the war. So many of them began talking about their situation as one that was unjust. The psychiatrists were talking about the treatment of homosexuals as a form of grave injustice the GI Bill gave a language of rights. People had rights as veterans. So they would talk about their rights being violated. They were treated as if they were a group of people that was all the same, that if you were a homosexual, then you belonged to this group and you were going to be treated as a group. And right after the war was when this talk of homosexuals being a persecuted minority, the use of the word minority, really begins being used in some magazines and other publications right after the war. So that language of rights, justice, minority, persecution, and appeals, redress of grievances, really grows out in part from the military experience. And it was the first gay male veterans the first gay organization in the United States that was a large membership organization was a group of gay veterans in New York City called the Veterans Benevolent Association, which was formed right after World War II.
Have you ever been in the military yourself?
No, I haven't.
Tell me why researching the military has become so important to you.
It's really funny. During the war in Vietnam, I was a conscientious objector, and now I'm seen as kind of an expert on military policy. It's a very strange turn of events. I'm realizing that the military plays a very important role in social in shaping society and in bringing about social change, either for the net positive or the negative. They really had a major role to play in integrating the armed forces. You know, when the armed forces were integrated racially in the early 1950s, that was ahead of many other organizations in the United States. The military was the first to bring about mandatory AIDS testing. It's a real pioneer in many ways, for the better or for the worse. It's also a place where many people who are poor and working class have their lives and even sexuality shaped by the military. And that's very interesting to me, to look at that part of the way social change comes about. And I think it's a real neglected part of social history, too.
Perhaps because so many gays and lesbians have formed alternative cultures in a way, since mm-hmm. they've been shut out of the mainstream in so many circumstances, it's hard to see the gay rights movement as being very compatible with the military, which is about regimentation, mm-hmm. and which do you think that there's anything like a gay rights movement within the military now, and are the two incompatible?
There are certainly different styles. There's the kind of counterculture style of gay liberation that came out of the late 60s and early 70s, and that, I would say, is pretty incompatible with military service. What's happened in the 80s, and certainly is going to happen in the 90s, is that the discussion of rights and gay men and lesbians is really broadening a lot. I think one thing that we're beginning to see now is that really extending to the armed forces, where people in the armed forces who are gay and lesbian are beginning to speak up, are saying, I cannot help anymore to maintain the lie that I'm not here. I'm here, and I have a right to be here like I have a right to be everywhere else. So there's a kind of a beginning of almost a gay rights or gay liberation movement that's coming from within the military, and it's going to have a very different style than the gay rights movement that grew out of the early 70s.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Berube is the author of the new book, Coming Out Under Fire, The History of Gay Men and Women in World War II. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's Conjunto Music, featuring bandleader and accordionist Steve Jordan. Coming up, world music critic Milo Miles gives us an introduction to Conjunto. Also, we meet a former CEO who doesn't make comparisons between running a competitive business and waging war. Max Dupree tells us how to run a successful company with a humanistic leadership style. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Miami Blues, starring Alec Baldwin as a bad guy who finds himself fighting crime. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Bredlin. Soviet troops occupied a Lithuanian printing plant by force today, ejecting 30 volunteer Nationalist Guards, and Lithuanian government officials claimed Moscow has started blocking delivery of some foodstuffs and other goods in its attempts to put down the Republic's drive for independence. The country's deputy prime minister said Cuban sugar bound for Lithuania was diverted and that metal and timber shipments have been stopped by the Soviets. The White House said today it was stepping up contacts with Western allies following the new Soviet actions against Lithuania, but would make no decisions on retaliation until early next week. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
Admittedly reluctant to take any action, the president has dragged out consultations with the allies, giving Soviet leader Gorbachev every opportunity to lift economic sanctions against Lithuania. But Mr. Bush warned yesterday there are limits to his patience. And following reports Moscow is now diverting not only fuel, but also food from the renegade republic, the president seems close to those limits. Despite or because of the dispute over Lithuania, the Soviet Union seems anxious to show its willingness to move forward on arms control agreements. The Soviet Union had been backing away from a number of important arms control deals. A meeting today provided no breakthroughs, but officials called the session between Secretary of State Baker and a top Soviet arms negotiator productive. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
U.S. diplomat John Kelly is on his way home to Washington despite the kidnappers' claim the failure to dispatch him to Syria delayed the release of an American hostage in Lebanon. The Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine had said it would free one of three Americans it's holding, but claimed yesterday the release was postponed because Washington refused a request to send Kelly to receive the hostage in Damascus. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater called the claim just a smokescreen. With East Germany's new democratically elected government committed to unity with West Germany, the Western allies are growing increasingly confident, however little it likes the idea, the Soviet Union will have to accept a united Germany as a member of NATO. In a note to Bonn, Moscow has again expressed its concerns about how the two Germanies plan to merge. Mark Brain with the BBC has this report.
Moscow's note to Bonn presses home Soviet concerns about the constitutional form German unity is now likely to take, with East Germany declaring its accession to the Federal Republic under Article 23 of the existing federal constitution. The Soviet Union has already sent a similar note to the new government in East Berlin, but in that memorandum it's reported to have gone further, reaffirming its opposition to a united Germany's membership of NATO. Those concerns, put bluntly, no longer appear to carry weight in Western capitals. Senior diplomats say they're now so certain of their negotiating strength on keeping Germany in NATO that they're not even prepared to grant Moscow the right to negotiate the issue. The East German government has already made clear it shares Western views.
The BBC's Mark Brain. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Sometimes world music performers are obscure not because they live far away, but because they're hard to track down. They're not interested in selling millions of albums and getting on MTV. World music commentator Milo Miles has the story of one such proud independent, accordionist Steve Jordan. Milo says while Jordan isn't a crossover artist, he does enjoy crossing musical boundaries.
Novia, vamos a bailar el cranque. Si te sientes medio caído y quieres aliviarte, That yipping wild man is Chicano bandleader Steve Jordan, often acclaimed as the fastest and most imaginative accordion player in the form known as conjunto, which literally means combo. There are several types of conjunto, but Jordan's is a kind of Mexican-American bar band music, featuring guitar, bass, and trap drums, as well as accordion. The 52-year-old Jordan is just so furiously eclectic that he keeps his conjunto sounding young, even avant-garde, by adding fresh rancheras, waltzes, and cumbias. Here he is absorbing country and western. And here he is tackling Caribbean salsa. But simple boldness won't prove Jordan's the true king of accordion squeezers. He belongs to the tradition of flashy, swaggering conjunto accordionists that began with Narciso Martinez in the 1930s and reached a sort of classical apex with Flaco Jimenez in the 1960s. What sets Jordan apart is not simply technical expertise, like his ability to play solos while singing, but his free-ranging rhythms, his unexpected chords, and his sweet and strange turns of sound that never fail.
Llegaron las coronelas.
Qué bien.
Háganlas pasar.
¿Qué pasa?
Que se haga el pobre.
¿Se
haga?
Jordan is a free spirit among free spirits. He's met the various hardships of his life by keeping in motion and slipping out of snares. He was blinded in one eye soon after birth, which led to his nickname, El Parche, or The Patch. Jordan's parents were migrant farm workers in the Southwest, and he grew up in desperate poverty with 15 brothers and sisters. Such a situation leaves little time for school, and Jordan was a professional musician by the time he was 14 and eventually learned to play some 30-odd instruments. Of course, the standard subject of Jordan's cantina repertoire is ill treatment at the hands of the opposite sex, surrounded by a haze of heavy drinking. But he often breaks away from cliché, as with a lament about an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, or this Springsteen-like number, The Ballad of Johnny the Pachuco. It's not that Jordan doesn't get around. He provided music for films like Born in East L.A. and Talking Heads' True Stories. He's recorded almost 40 albums, but none of them under contract. He's done 20 years of one-shot deals. His latest is a collection of late 70s and early 80s singles called El Huracan, and it is a strong blower. Still, Jordan likes the wide open spaces and is as likely to be fishing for shrimp as making the weekend gig. But if you're ever in South Texas and hear a dervish accordion in a dance hall down the street, it just might be El Parche squeezing them dead again.
Music of Steve Jordan. Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. In 1988, a Fortune magazine poll of executives and analysts picked Herman Miller as one of the 10 most admired companies in the country. The company has been manufacturing furniture since 1923, when it was founded by D.J. Dupree. The company's designers have included George Nelson and Charles Eames. Its best-known product is the 1956 Eames lounge chair. D.J. Dupree's son Max took over the leadership of the company in 1980 and ran it for 8 years. As CEO, Max was known for managing through respect, not intimidation, viewing the company as a community built on relationships among employees. Max Dupree describes his management style in his book, Leadership is an Art. He tells a story about his father's early days at the company, a story which set the tone for the company's future management.
It's the story of the millwright, who in those days, in the 20s, was a crucial figure in a small manufacturing company, because that was before the days of electric motors. And so a machine room, which, for instance, ran saws, drill presses, that kind of thing, all kinds of equipment, was all run by a pulley system, so that every machine was run by a pulley from the main drive, and the main drive was run by the steam engine, and the steam engine was driven by the waste, burning the waste from the operation. So it was a beautiful cycle. And the person who had to make sure all of that worked was the millwright. So he was indispensable. He came before everybody did, made sure the factory was ready to run, and then stayed till after everybody left. And that was his job. And one day, he died. And my father was still a relatively young manager at the time, didn't quite know what to do about such a situation, but decided that he should go call on the family. And he did, and he met in the living room with the widow and the children. And during the course of the visit, the widow asked if it would be okay if she read some poetry. And, of course, my father said, sure. So she went to another room and came out with a bound book and sat and read for several minutes from this book, and it was beautiful poetry. And when she finished, my father said, "That's really beautiful. Who wrote that?" And she said, "My husband did." Well, as he was walking home from that visit, he began to struggle with a question that we really struggle with even today, which is, did we have a millwright who wrote poetry, or did we have a poet who did millwright work?
What difference did it make to you in one way or another?
The difference that it made to me as I was growing up as a manager is that it explained to me in a graphic way that there's a lot more to every person we come across than is instantly visible. And that we had to understand that the people that we work with are usually deeper and have more potential than what a given job may require. Another thing that it taught me is that there's a breadth to our diversity that's very important. And if as a leader you decide that you're going to put an emphasis on reaching potential, as, for instance, compared to reaching goals, then you need that understanding of the uncommonness of persons.
There are 5,000 people in your company. How can you keep a sense of everybody's personal, individual nature when you're dealing with a company of that size?
Well, you work at it in two ways. One is that I think as a leader, you make a conscious decision that you're going to put an emphasis in your own life and work on relationships as compared to agendas. And the other is you try to discover ways in which you can actually be in touch in a meaningful way with as many people as possible. Can I give you an example?
Sure.
One of the things that you hear occasionally in so-called business literature is that there's such a thing as management by walking around. To me, that's only a partial answer. What we did when I was a CEO is it was required of the six people on my work team that once a month, each of us had a brown bag luncheon with at least 12 people in the company, and we could not pick the agenda. In other words, we always had to deal with agenda that was brought to the table by the employees, and the meeting had to go on for at least an hour. Well, you see, as compared, for instance, to managing by walking around, this gives people an opportunity to not only enter into a discussion with you, but to examine the discussion, which is what you have to do if you're going to have meaningful relationships.
Now, who would those 12 people be who would meet with you? Because I've noticed that a lot of corporations are very uncomfortable about people from the bottom part of the pyramid talking directly to the people at the top part of the pyramid.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of people in organizations who are very insecure about that. But, you see, it improves the quality of communication throughout the organization if all so-called levels are interacting together. If a middle manager knows that at some point some of her employees are going to be talking to the CEO, then she's going to be much sharper about the way in which she communicates with her group. There are some risks in that, but the advantages far outweigh the risks. And the way we did it is we allowed people to volunteer for these meetings. Nobody had to come to the meetings.
Mm-hmm. You have to make it really clear that you're not going to hold anything against someone if they say something negative to you or about you.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Was that ever hard for you to do?
Someone
has the guts to tell you something that they think is really wrong, either with your management style or with the company?
Yeah, sometimes it's difficult. I had an experience, which was a good experience for me, quite a few years ago when I was doing that. A young woman in the group turned to me and said, why don't you approve of babies by adoption? And I said, well, I do. She said, no, you don't. I said, well, I do. She said, you do not. And I said, well, you know, tell me more. She said, if you really approved of having babies by adoption, you would have a fringe benefit for it. But this company only pays for natural babies. And I didn't know that. And so later we got two or three of us together and talked with her further about it. And it took us about 2 weeks to change the policy so that adopted babies were also paid for by the company benefit program.
What's an example of a time when you were faced with perhaps an economic crisis where you had to do something you really didn't want to do, such as laying off workers? I don't know if that's happened to you, but if it has, I'm sure it was difficult to figure out how to do it, how to handle it.
Yeah, it happens, I think, in most companies on a kind of a cyclical basis. You do reach these points where you need to flatten management, as they say these days, or where you're overstaffed and you've been too optimistic in adding people, or orders fall off. And so you do have to have some layoffs from time to time. I think that one of the techniques that we developed for dealing with it, probably the best technique, and we don't always use it, but we use it most of the time, is we communicate with people about what's happening, and then we invite volunteers. And in many parts of the country, there are periods when people are happy to volunteer to be laid off. And we've had many times when people have said, well, you know, our family's in pretty good shape. We can take some time off. We'll let the younger people stay on. Or we've had situations where two spouses work and one will say, okay, in the interest of the whole problem, one of us will take time off for a while. So we found that the fairest and most effective way to handle some of those layoffs has been through volunteering for time off.
And that's with the understanding that there'd be a time when they would be rehired?
Well, usually with the understanding that if rehires become possible, they'd be first on the list.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So instead of you seeming to arbitrarily make cuts, it becomes more of a cooperative decision in a way.
Yes, that's right. But now I don't want to give you the impression that we always do it so beautifully. We do make some cuts, and sometimes we make cuts in ways that we shouldn't do it, and we feel badly about that afterwards, and I hope we learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
We do have clay feet.
You've written a book on leadership. Have you ever read one of those management textbooks yourself? A textbook or one of the pop books that have been in such vogue for the past few years?
Well, not for quite a few years. Quite a few years ago, I read especially Peter Drucker's things.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1980, when I became a CEO, Peter has been a consultant to Herman Miller for a good many years, and he and I have become good friends. He said to me, you know, you really ought to stop reading business books. You know how to manage a company, and you don't have much time, and you ought to just read what really appeals to you. So I must say, I haven't read any of those books for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Your book, Leadership is an Art, it's a small book in a time of very thick books. And the print is looks like triple space to me.
Yeah.
Was that your idea to leave that much space between each line?
Yes, because, you know, leadership is something that we don't know enough about. And I wanted people to be able to contribute to the book. I saw it actually as a participative book. And so, as I mentioned in the introduction, I like people both to read between the lines and write between the lines. Because what I was encouraging them to do was not only to read the book, but to own the book by finishing it. They can, and in fact, one man wrote and told me he had added 5 pages to my book, which I think is terrific.
Max Dupree is now chairman of the board of Herman Miller. His book, Leadership is an Art, is published by Doubleday. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll check in with Vilnius, the capital of the Republic of Lithuania, to see how things are going after the Soviet cutoff of oil and natural gas supplies there. Albania's president has surprisingly opened the way for reestablishment of relations with the West and with Moscow. Albania has been fiercely independent, in fact, at times almost hostile to the West. Bob Mondello reflects on efforts to colorize some more great old black and white movies and efforts to fight that. And NPR's Michael Scholar reports on a community in southeastern Ohio started 20 years ago by a group of former Quakers trying to live a life that is environmentally conscientious.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new thriller, Miami Blues, opens this weekend in theaters across the country. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
At the movies, criminals generally fall into 3 categories. Either they're ringleaders, which means they're steely, calculating, and vicious, or they're psychos, which is the same as the ringleaders, only more lonely and demented, or else they're bumblers, which means they're goofy, comically inept, well-intentioned, and often rather endearing. In real life, of course, criminals are more likely to be none of the above, or maybe a chaotic combination of all 3. Junior, the sociopath at the center of Miami Blues, is a little like that. He's vicious but endearing, bumbling but calculating. He's a hodgepodge of odd traits, and so's the movie. Miami Blues is violent and funny, and like Junior himself, it always seems on the verge of exploding. Junior's played by Alec Baldwin, who makes his character magnetically glib and volatile, a dangerous charmer who outwits himself, at least as often as he outwits the world. We meet him as he lands in Miami, blithely stealing a suitcase from a sleeping mother and then breaking a Hare Krishna's finger, whereupon the Krishna promptly dies of shock. Junior's daily routine is a matter of exploring the world for opportunities, a purse to snatch here, a drug dealer to rip off there. But he begins to yearn for a more domestic life when he meets Susie, a spectacularly dim hooker played with gorgeous solemnity by Jennifer Jason Leigh. In this scene, they've barely met, but you can already hear what a hurry they're in to invest their hopes in one another.
I got a $10,000 CD, and I take the interest from that and I put it into a nail account.
Jesus Christ, that's the biggest friggin' racket going. I want you to march straight down to the bank first thing in the morning and cash in both of those things. I can't let my fiance get ripped off when I can double your money.
Double?
Yeah. How about that poem we were gonna write?
The writer-director, George Armitage, comes from the Roger Corman school of low-budget action movie making. And you might characterize his style as more bang for the buck. Miami Blues is cunningly written, but it's also jumpy and wild and full of ideas. So much so that I've noticed not many critics have caught the movie's point. Let me explain. Hot on the trail of the so-called Krishna finger killer, Detective Hoke Mosley, played by Fred Ward, invites himself to dinner with his new suspects, Junior and Susie. The next day, Junior breaks into Hoke's pitifully run-down room, beats the detective to a pulp, and steals, among other things, his dentures and his badge. Now Junior gets to play cop. He can flash the badge and shoot at other perpetrators. Soon he's foiling almost as many crimes as he commits, and he's not sure which he prefers. It's this weird dilemma that's at the heart of the movie's admittedly ghoulish humor. Junior's all hyped up, eager to do as much evil as he can fit into a day, when suddenly the prospect of doing good raises its ugly head. And as a do-gooder, well, Junior just doesn't have the requisite skills. I don't want to make any grandiose claims for Miami Blues. It has its share of loose ends. And as juicy as Fred Ward's acting is, his hoke is never very vivid. Still, Miami Blues is good, nasty fun, and craftsmanly, too. Watch for the scene that involves a concoction called vinegar pie. It's as elegant and eloquent a piece of filmmaking as I've seen all year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Today we welcome the listeners of a station that just started broadcasting Fresh Air, WMOT in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Fresh Air's interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Joan Tui. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and arts commentaries. It's all edited and mixed by Roberta Shurrock and Allison Dufty. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Rap music concerts have been accused of inciting violence. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Nelson George, a music critic who helped organize Stop the Violence, a group of rappers rapping against black-on-black crime. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue featuring the late Jack Teagarden. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.